supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From WHYY and First Person Arts in Philadelphia, this is Common Space, where live stories connect us to each other and the world. I'm your host, Jamie J., and I'll take you deeper into the stories with conversations that just might challenge your perceptions. I am here in the studio with some of First Person Arts storytellers.
Hi, everybody. My name's Nick Kupsey.
Hello, I'm Marjorie Winther.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Lafferty.
Hey, everybody. This is Chris Lundy.
Hello, friends. I am Nimisha Ladva.
Howdy. This is Jeff Jackson.
So we have come to the end of the second season of Common Space, and we've gathered together some of our beloved, but not all, of our beloved storytellers from the past two seasons to just talk about storytelling and how it's impacted our life and talk about Common Space, any revelations. So I'm just going to ask you to think of yourselves, you know, at my dining room table when I didn't cook, you know, and let's just talk. And I'm, you know, going to throw something out there. The very first time I went to a story slam, a woman got up on the stage and she talked about being in love with a man that did not see her true beauty and how she had evolved beyond that hurt and pain to find a lush, sexy, romantic life. And I thought to myself in the first row looking up at her that this lady is my hero. I am talking about no other than Marjorie Winther. You know, and this idea that storytelling connected me to a woman that if we were walking down the same street in opposite directions, we never would have met. But because she opened up and told that story, I fell in love that day.
Wow, Jamie, I wish a lush, sexy, brunch-filled life to everyone in this room. But I do want to say, because that particular story that I told came out of a trauma in my life. And what you were talking about, sharing things that we wouldn't ordinarily talk about, my husband of 30 years went to prison. And that was my first story, was finding out that he had a secret life and being completely ripped to shreds and turning it into comedy and turning it into story. And that I connected with you on that day because it ended up a story of redemption and joy. And that means more to me than anything, that I could touch you in that way.
Well, you certainly did. And I appreciate you for that. We are this round table of mishmashed people that I don't think would ever, but by the grace of First Person Arts, know each other. And I mean, really have some insight into each other. What makes you want to tell your story on stage?
I grew up being expected to be silent and obedient. So having the courage to stand up and say something that is true and realize that A, you can do it, and B, that it makes a difference, is a miracle every time I get to do it. And it's such a privilege. And after I do some of my storytellings or a show, I often get to talk to people, and I am, it's hard for me to even get this out, but I am as moved by them as they say they are by my stories. And it's incredible to me that this little brown girl who grew up in a pretty straight-out racist environment in England, where I was invisible when I wanted to be visible and visible when I wanted to be invisible, to take the time to tell a story where I feel like I have some control over my visibility and some act and agency in creating a shared space of community and communication is a gift every single time. So, Jamie, thank you always for giving me and everyone in this room the space to do that.
What was that moment? That moment of transformation, that moment of transition when you told a story and something changed everything. Either you told one or you heard one. And I'll give you a quick example. I remember Dale Orlander Smith, Obie Award winner, Pulitzer Prize finalist. She was telling a story about growing up in Harlem in a rat-infested home and her difficulties with her mother. And Dale is a African-American woman with these long dreads down her back with a thick New York accent. And after the show was over, in the very back of the room was this very elegant, blue-haired, well-heeled white woman who stood up and said, "Dale, your mother was my mother." And at that moment, I knew that the power of stories could cross economics, color, situation, everything. That was my aha moment. Did anybody else have an aha moment like that?
I did. So when I tell stories, I typically lean toward the comedy. It's just my comfort zone. And what appeals to me, and just to go back to the question about the courage, because I'm scared every time, every single time. But agreement appeals to me. And what I mean by that is I may think something's funny, but that's just me. But when I deliver it, and the whole crowd laughs, that's agreement. That's everyone else saying, "We think that was funny too." And that sense of community, it really appeals to me. It feels accepting, it feels warm, and it energizes me, you know, and that's what kind of feeds the courage to keep going. So I guess it was the first time I was on stage and got a pretty raucous laugh at something I said, that's when it all changed. And I was like, whoa. I thought it was just me that thought that was funny. Everyone agrees. Let me try it again. And that's what happened.
I'm also very comfortable with jokes. Mm-hmm. And I've challenged myself over and over to not tell a funny story. And I've found, like, sometimes I'm writing and I'm weeping as I'm writing. This is so sad and I'm going to tell this. And I get on stage and it's hilarious. I don't know why. But it's that, like, I remember a line. I was in love with an alcoholic at the time and it was a painful. And I said, but he wasn't just an alcoholic. He was also a poet. It wasn't intended to be funny, but it's that connection because we've all loved that poet.
So true. So true.
How about vulnerability? Going deep.
I'm not afraid of being vulnerable. That doesn't scare me. I think that going up there, not performing, is what terrifies me, if that makes sense. Ooh. The opposite. I'd rather perform. I feel safer and more at home on a stage than I do in a tiny conversation at a party. And that is what I've learned through doing storytelling, is that I am way more comfortable in front of 200, 300 people than I am in like four anymore. I never thought that that would be a thing, especially at my age, where I would be uncomfortable in small group settings, but completely okay alone with a microphone. So that was a very big surprise for me as I've delved deeper into this life. It doesn't stem from some sort of like need to perform all the time. It's not that at all. I think that it's just somewhere where I feel more comfortable now. And I never thought that – I was always more of a people person. And as I've gotten older, it's weird to see that polar shift where I'm like, okay, I'm more comfortable talking to people I don't know than – not that I can't discuss things with people. I can hold a conversation. It's not that. But if you gave me my choice would be 300 people I don't know.
Let's go back to this going deep. That takes me to Jeff Jackson. What was that experience like for you? You told a particularly poignant, compelling story.
Oh, well, what I find particularly appealing about the first-person arts environment and the storytelling environment in particular is the willingness of the audience. So people go into the theater, they go into the nightclub with an expectation. And having performed in a lot of other venues, a lot of different types of performance with poetry or theater or with sketch comedy or improv comedy or stand-up comedy, I find I'm often trying to do the same thing. My objective is the same. with very wildly variable results. And the storytelling, the audience is game for anything. They are so sweet and so compassionate and attentive, which may surprise people. Most audiences are not necessarily game for anything. We came for a comedy show. It's 90 seconds in, and it's not uproariously funny. I am disappointed in this experience. Whereas if it's a storytelling show, somebody can take to the stage and they can start speaking, and you kind of get a sense of where they're going, but people they're strapped in, and they're there for the duration. If one has the sense that the audience is on board, then it is possible to say things that one has wanted to say publicly, in my instance, for many years, but not had the ability or like the access to express that kind of material. Though attempts have been made, often disastrous. like, who's this Jackson kid? Who booked him? He's never playing this stand-up comedy club again. But to do it in a storytelling setting, people are like, wow, that was great. We'd love to see you next month. Here we have all of our themes published. Come back in 2 months. Come back in 3 months. We'd love to have you host a thing. So, yeah, love it.
You know what else I think about, too, is what was it like to hear your story on the air on WHYY? And it could be, you know, something really deeply personal.
I think in my case, it was something that turned the storytelling experience completely on its head, because how it happened for me as a newbie cutting my teeth, knowing my heroes and how well they do it and trying to find that ground for me, I went there for that first time and I was ready to slam dunk a story, and I did it. And someone named Jamie J happened to be hosting that night, and I could not be more grateful that she was hosting that night, because I got up there and I knew I did what I set out to do that night. I knew I did it. For the first time, I was like, that's how it's done. And I got sixes and sevens. That is, for those of you that are uninitiated, the thank you for coming, have a seat rating you get from the judges. But it didn't change how I felt. I knew it. And bless you, Jamie J, you turned around and came to me and you said, some people are not ready to hear that story yet. Mm-hmm. And that was one voice. Sometimes you get everybody. Sometimes the Lundys and the Marjories, they do it every time. Your mastery blows my mind. But in that one night, there was one person who told me. And I told a story also, but it was also personal likewise, that, you know, it was solid, but, you know, it wasn't the winner that night. And somebody came up to me afterwards. It's the times when somebody does come along and say, that meant something to me. And I've had that happen, because I tend to go, I'm the opposite of Nick, I guess. I do well with the captive audience, the people who know me, because they know how crazy I am. And I can own it in those small environments. And then I get up there and I kind of feel like a little bit kryptonite, you know. So I'm working on that. But so to hear that story, that six and seven story, come to the air, my hands were shaking. I was in my car. I shouldn't have been driving when I was listening to it. And because it was also so deeply personal, it was the first step I took in confronting something. It was a central part of something I'm confronting as a whole. And it's been a huge catalyst for me. So let me be the first, if we haven't already said it, and we've kind of touched on it, that healing is such a huge place. When you're ready to tell that story, you know it. And you need to tell it. You really do.
I just wanted to remark on the inadvertent audience that you sometimes end up having. So I was actually telling a story here at Common Space for an event, and I was leaving, and the security guard stopped me. And he was an older man in his 60s, I would guess. And because he was a security guard and he held me, initially I thought, well, what did I do wrong? Why is he holding me? Sorry was the first thing out of my mouth. And when I looked at him more closely, I saw that there were tears in his eyes. And I had just finished telling a part of my immigration story. And he said, I am really glad that you are here. I've been a black man in Philadelphia all my life, and I have struggled so much with what I have had to do. I never knew that other people had it hard too. He said, I'm glad that you're here. And I looked at him and I realized I had always assumed an easy solidarity with people of color, and I had, in my own way, fail to recognize exactly how hard it was for him to grow up in his conditions here in Philadelphia. And we both were at a point where there was nothing more to say except hug each other. And that's what we did. And that changed everything.
You realize we have more in common, regardless of how unique our experiences may feel to us. We actually have a lot in common.
What Kat was saying about telling a story because she was confronting something in her life, and I think for me too, it is sharing that narrative, but it's also discovering your own narrative that propels you forward. Because any experience, you can write 1,000 different stories about, and you can choose to write one that's empowering. And when you do that, you give yourself courage, and you give courage to those around you.
Okay. What was the deepest secret you revealed about yourself in a story on stage? Yeah, come on, let's go.
That before I went to pull the plug on my father, I got stoned. That was the deepest and darkest. And it turned out I didn't have to, thank the Lord. But there was a great shame in that to begin with. So it felt good to tell other people that, hey, this is what I did before I was supposed to essentially end my father's life. And thankfully it didn't happen, but it's always been a great shame of mine. And I didn't tell anybody. So telling a group of people made it unburdened me. So afterwards, I remember after saying this, I was like, wow, I feel a lot better. Like, I feel great. And my friends were in there, they're like, wow, you are an interesting individual. But it did feel good to say that. And it was the worst day of my life. So I think that if people take and they understand that, they can understand why and how close I was with my father and how difficult that was for me to do.
For me, I guess it was not long after I spilled my guts and said, here I am, this is deep to me, and gave that story. And it didn't go over so well with the audiences, but I was still determined, and I still wanted to succeed on that stage. I went back next month, and I was like, I'm going to tell a story about how I ran out of a restaurant bill. And it had to do with a job I used to do, okay? So I'm a middle-aged woman now, and, you know, I am a mom. I'm the den leader. I'm you know, this whole cookie-cutter thing. And I dropped the whole history I had of being a professional dominatrix. So, and I thought it was a funny story. I did get some great laughs, and that did feel good. So, I mean, I felt like just for a second that I was like a Marjorie or a Lundy just for that one day. But I still didn't win. So I'm like, oh, what did I do?
But what more do I have to do to win a story slam?
That's it, I'm done. And, of course, I'm not done. Here I am. You know, it's okay, though. Those are all little baby steps because it all relates. It all comes back. I mean, since telling those two stories, those are two huge seismic things, and it's not a coincidence when we tell stories. They're ones that are bubbling to the surface. They're waiting to come out. And the truth is, I ended up in that business because my first career, it didn't go so well for me. And that really is where my self-esteem was at the end of it. This is what I can do.
Probably the most vulnerable I've ever been. It was a story slam. I did not win that one. And it was about how I've always felt that my belly makes me unlovable. Mm-hmm. And I can hide behind this sort of sassy persona. And that was hard to admit.
What did you get a unique response from anyone in the audience after you told that story?
I mean, I don't know, because it was a whole story then about bellies and about sort of being sexual while fat is an act of subversiveness. And so I, you know, feel philosophical. But the real vulnerability was in that opening.
You're my hero again.
Because I like to, you know, try my best to be humorous, typically when I'm admitting things, it's like, for example, I broke up with a girl because she said that Grease 2 was the best Grease. After that, I couldn't trust her. But there was one time where I did tell a more serious story, and it was when I was a child. I was responsible, at least, you know, for years, I blamed myself. I was responsible for the kidnap of my best friend. His mother was extremely abusive, and they had, you know, fled her, the father had remarried and all that, and she had came around the neighborhood, found him somehow, and I was the ringleader of my whole friends group, you know. If I said we were playing tag, well, we were playing tag, damn it. And she tricked me, though. she told me that it was a surprise and that we should, you know, go ask him if he could come out, go ask his parents if he can come out and play, and it'll be all great. And I did it, executed it to a T, and she grabbed him, threw him in the car, and it took months before they found him again. But I remember the guilt I felt. Too young to even be able to identify guilt. I didn't even know what that feeling was. But I remember, you know, not wanting to go outside, coming straight home from school and just going into my room for a really long time. I didn't want to see the family, didn't want to look them in the eye. But I think that's probably the most vulnerable I've ever been on stage was telling that story, you know, and just reminiscing about those feelings from my childhood as I told that story.
Did you get any response from anyone in the audience when you told that story?
I did. It was the first time I ever saw the audience just completely still. You know, it was the very first time. Usually there's, you know, laughter here, movement. It was a completely still audience. And that I consider a response, you know, within itself. It was a happy ending. I was actually partly responsible for them finding him. But, yeah, that was a rough one.
Anybody else? Any other special moments around sharing stories?
Sure. Well, there were things that I tried to talk about before, but they weren't successful, and I wasn't able to get them out in a way that anybody listened effectively. But probably, I guess the to go deep dish, which is a phrase a friend of mine uses, mm-hmm. Of which I'm very fond. But probably the biggest deep dish moment was not just discussing attempts on my own life, which I have made on multiple occasions and have talked about, again, with varying degrees of success over the years, always trying to make it funny because that's just how I process human life. That's how I process my existence. But being able to describe particulars of like getting dressed up and taking out my best clothes and ironing my shirt and ironing my slacks and getting the lint out of my crushed velvet three-quarter length coat to go and like polishing my boots and going down to the train tracks to lay on the tracks in the most dramatic way possible. But normally, I would try to do that like at a stand-up comedy show, and they'd be like, cut, turn off this guy's microphone. Turn off his microphone. He's talking about ironing. No one wants to hear about this, before I even got into the meat of it. So I guess that's probably the deepest dish I've dished.
How about comments that we've gotten from audience members or anything funny, super funny, that somebody may have said to you after you told a story, or even a family member or someone?
I remember people after I told that story, and I closed with like, thank you for listening. Please don't talk to me about this.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of people talked to me about it.
And then
I was like, okay, I'm just going to go to the bar. I'm going to get a drink. And then these guys kept coming up to me. I'm like, thank you so much. And there was this position where I felt obligated because they were opening up to respect the difficulty that they faced in telling me about it. But I was also a little miffed because they weren't following the explicit instruction I'd given them.
I was one of those people. Love you, and we were worried about you, and we wanted you to know we loved you.
Oh, well, that was different with you, Jamie. Thank you.
Google does spoil everything. So I'm a teacher, and every fall I walk into a brand new classroom, and it turns out that my students have Googled me before they come to class. And it took me a while to figure out what stories they have been listening to. But then one day, some girls came up to me after class, and I said, well, you know, if you want to talk about oral communication, I could help you if that's something you're nervous about. Like, oh, we know you tell stories. I'm like, okay. Like, yeah, we love the ones about you being a kid and being a teenager. I was like, that's great. They left, and then I realized the only explicit teenager story I have that comes to mind is, wait a minute. I walked into a party as a teenager feeling so fantastic because I was wearing like a normal American swimsuit that I'd hidden from my parents, and I'd gone to all lengths to sort of get away with doing this swim party. But I had forgotten in my haste and excitement to remove my undergarments. And I was informed by the young man whose birthday party it was. It was his sister who'd invited me, but it was his sister's birthday party. I'm like, wait, my students know this about me now.
Right.
It does change the, it does sort of speed up the vulnerability work in the classroom. Like, they know you're real, and I sure did that. I walked into a swim party with a fabulous swimsuit and my underwear.
And it's true, because now when you give somebody your name, right, you meet somebody new, you meet them online or whatever, and you say, hey, here's my name, and they Google you, and all of a sudden all these YouTube videos come up with the secrets that you would want people to discover by getting to know you. Well, they're out there.
I've been seeing someone for a few months, and when we first started dating, we had gone on a few dates, and it was very pleasant, and I liked her. And she goes, oh, so I Googled you, and I found all of your stories and just went through every single one. And I was like, oh, that's tragic. Like, I don't know how this is going to work out for me. But it did. But that is a component you have to take into consideration when you perform, that other people that don't know you are going to see it, or people that have some sort of interest in you are going to look for you. So I don't take that into consideration, because they're going to find out anyway. You know, if you get close enough to me, these are things that I would tell you regardless.
So, Chris, you have told a lot of relationship stories.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I'm curious to know, has this affected your dating life? Yes, ladies, Chris is single.
Yeah. No, it has. It has. There was, let me not say the exact show it was. Let me stay out of trouble. But there was a young lady who she saw me at a show, and we had, that was pretty much our intro. And then we had gone out, and I could tell she was expecting me to just perform and have her dying laughing. And I'm sitting across the table like, so how's it going? And it must have been such a disappointment, because I'm just like, I just want to talk and maybe, you know, drink and eat. And but she, because that was the first time she had seen me, she thought I was going to do this whole, you know, 5-minute story with the crescendo at the end. I'm like, no, I just kind of hanging out here.
I had a guy tell me, he looked at the videos and he goes, you're so much more talkative on stage.
So you know.
So just as we started our very first Common Space episode around immigration, and we had a roundtable discussion where everyone in the Common Space team participated and began a journey together that has allowed us to become, I think, more than friends. And now, after 2 seasons of Common Space Stories in partnership with WHYY, here we are with some of our beloved storytellers with a grateful heart. They have each been gracious and kind and giving of themselves. And I just want to thank you all on behalf of WHYY and Common Space and Elizabeth Perez Luna, who has been our fearless executive producer and leader, Nick Cupsey, Marjorie Winther, Kat Lath, Chris Lundy, Namisha Ladva, Jeff Jackson. We love you all, and please, any parting words?
Storytelling is the best. I love it deeply. I have no doubt the performance is why I am on this planet and what I'm here to do, and this seems to be the best place in which to do it, and you've been nothing but welcoming. Thank you ever so much.
You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Check us out at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Our Common Space team includes executive producer and co-writer Elizabeth Perez Luna, producer Mike Villers, associate producers Ali Lesmeros and Jen Cleary, Tanisha Ford from First Person Arts, and archivist Dr. Neil Barden. Our engineer was Al Banks, and our theme music is by Subglow. I'm your host, producer, and co-writer, Jamie J. Thanks so much for listening.